On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Counterpoint with Michael Duffy and Paul Comrie Thompson. There's nothing else quite like it on your ABC.
And now it's time to go back to the 1970s. Gough Whitlam has been elected as Australia's first Labor Prime Minister in over 20 years. Australian troops are out of Vietnam. The OPEC oil crisis erupts in response to the US decision to supply the Israeli military during what was called the Fourth Arab-Israeli War. Hard economic times hit. And Michael Wilding, a writer and lecturer at the University of Sydney, meets a dynamic California girl called Pat Woolley. She says to him offhandedly, "I'd like to set up a publishing company and call it Wild and Woolley." He responds, "Do you know my name?" "No," she replies, without interest. Sometime later, Wilding flew to California to join up with Pat Woolley, and an amazing publishing adventure began.
See, I was a great enthusiast for Kerouac and the Beats, so we drove from LA up through Big Sur, where Henry Miller had lived and where Kerouac wrote his novel Big Sur, and then up to San Francisco, and we found the City Lights office. We went to the bookshop, and they said, "No, the publishing's around the corner." We went in there, and we said, "We started a publishing and distribution company, and your books aren't available in Australia, and we'd like to handle them." And Ferlinghetti sort of smiled, and he took down his bowler hat and put it on. We took a photograph. It was the hat Charlie Chaplin had worn in City Lights. And that was it. And then we sort of drove around some more. And,
so you got the gig to distribute some books?
Well, I didn't say anything.
Pat Woolley did all the talking?
Yeah. And we came back to Australia, and Pat came back. She changed her mind. She thought everybody in LA there was mad as when she'd left, so she came back. And then one day, and we decided we'd start publishing. And then one day we got an order to supply some City Light books. That was the first we knew that we were the official distributors. We didn't have any stock, we didn't have a warehouse, we didn't have an office, so we thought, oh, better get started.
So this actually started with a Pat Woolley designed rubber stamp and some blank cards. Were you actually incorporated at this?
No. When we came back, I went down the pub, the old Newcastle, and the Maury Isaacs was one of the people who used to drink
that
down
was from
there.
Morris Isaacs and Glass, a famous
divorce lawyer.
Yes.
So we said, you know, could he set up a company? He said, well, I don't usually do this. I usually do divorce. But anyway, he did it. So we set up a company. And
Michael Wilding, there was considerable cultural optimism in 70s Australia, just as you're describing it. I mean,
well, it's interesting because, I mean, everybody says, this was the Whitlam years. But this was the optimism had been before. The optimism came from the late 60s when the culture was changing. You know, the baby boom kids were 18, whatever, by then. And people were writing things. And the whole scene in Sydney around Balmain, in Melbourne around Carlton and so on, the pubs were full of poets, you know, more poets than you'd really want to meet. But they were there, and they were producing little Gestetner magazines. You remember the Machine Gun of the Revolution, the Ronio magazine?
I do, yes.
Nigel Roberts had Free Poetry and so on. So there was a lot of writing going on, but the publishing scene was dominated by overseas corporations, then as now, and they weren't terribly interested in local talent. They were making enough money from the imports. So it was very hard to get anything into print. The literary quarterlies were still coming out then, and they were still coming out quarterly, but they were rather serious and academic and a bit sniffy about the sort of younger generation stuff. So there was a lot of energy, and in Balmain, the Balmain Reading started, where people just, you know, you'd find somebody who had a waterfront house and you'd say, "Why don't you have a reading here?" And then the whole pub would come down there in the evening and you'd read, you know, and if people didn't like it, they'd throw a beer
throw
can.
Throw stuff at you.
Yeah, but empty beer cans, because they weren't going to waste the drink, so it wasn't too dangerous, you know. And so there was a lot happening. There was an audience. It was an oral culture at that time. So there was a lot of work around. And University of Queensland Press had just mutated from being a textbook publisher into publishing some paperback poets and so on. And then they decided to do a paperback prose series, and Frank Thompson had taken my book as the first in the series. So things were slowly starting to happen. But there was still a lot of material. There were a lot of people who'd written stuff, and we knew they'd got, you know, boxes of manuscripts. So, it was all waiting to happen.
So into this.
But it came from a period of repression.
Yes.
You know, not from the Whitlam years of success, but from that the clamping down of the old Liberal Country Party coalition.
Yes. So into this situation, arrives the dynamo from California and the academic from Sydney, and he says, hey, we're Wild and Woolly, we're a publishing company. And what were some of your early successes? What was your first published book?
The first published book was actually John Silkin, who was an English poet who ran a very good literary quarterly called Stand, and I was his Australian editor, and I arranged to bring him out as the first writer in residence. There was a literature board scheme for writers in residence. And he had a new book coming out from a small press in England, and he wanted to sell it in Australia, so we said, OK, well, we'll buy a run-on of it. So we just had our title page put on it, and it was a rather hideously designed book. And a friend of mine picked it up, said it was the worst book he'd ever seen in his life, the worst-looking book he'd ever seen. But that was our first book, OK? The stocks of that arrived from England before we'd actually got anything printed. But the first we published was Robert Adamson, who was living in Balmain at the time and had just he'd been in jail and boys' home since the age of eight. Had come out, he'd established himself as a prison poet. You know, there were a lot of prison writers, but Bob was the best and the one who survived. And he'd written a memoir of being in jail with Bruce Hanford, an American. And it had been serialised in Digger magazine. You remember the
Digger, yes.
And Bob had never quite finished it, and Hanford was supposed to have had him locked up in a room, you know, to make him finish it, you know, back in jail again. And so I said, look, why don't we do a book out of this? So he gave me all the cuttings and bits of manuscript, and we put them in some sort of order and shaped it. And then Vicky Vidicus, who was a short story writer and poet, ran the scene. She had this little cardboard suitcase of manuscripts she used to carry around, and I'd helped her do a book of poems. University of Queensland Press had published her poems, and she'd sent them 250 pages, and they only wanted 52, you know, so we cut them down. So having done that, I said, look, why don't we do a book of your stories? So Vicky's book and Bob's book were the first two, and Bob had already published a book of poems. Vicky had already published a book of poems, so they were not totally unknown. They'd had some notice, so we weren't sort of starting from scratch, but we built on that, and they were the first two titles, and they established us.
What do you treasure most about Wild and Woolly in the 70s, say from 73 to 79?
I was the sense we were doing something. We were getting books out, and there was a sense of community. I was talking to Evelyn Dewars, who with Ivor Indic runs Giramondo, who published my memoir. That's why I was talking to them, right? And she was saying, but you know, when you did that, there was a sense of a community, and there was. But then we created that community. I mean, it was people we knew. You know, Bob and Vicky were good friends. Nigel Roberts, I knew, was a friend. You know, down from the Forth and Clyde in Balmain. And then people would recommend people, and you, there was some coherence to the publishing list. It represented a sort of alternative culture. You know, there was a lot in common amongst the writers. So it was cohesive. And I think if you're going to start a magazine or a publishing house, then there has to be some sort of aesthetic or political or spiritual vision, some coherence to it. And we had that. And that was the spirit of the times. It changed. The 80s got greedy and miserable and horrible, and that had all gone. But for that decade, we were on the wave and we were part of it, and everybody was supportive. People were eager for this to happen. The press, the newspapers were looking for something new. They were glad to get Australian content again. They weren't, you know, obsessively interviewing, you know, Michael and Nutchie or, you know, Dutchie or whatever his bloody name is. Every weekend now you see some overseas writer being interviewed. For once, there was an interest in local literary production. And the women's magazines, Vogue, Clio, Cosmo, they were all on side. They were promoting us, interviewing us, running excerpts. Some German writer came out, he couldn't believe it. He said, what are you doing in this women's magazine? Well, we go anywhere, you know. But there was the media culture was interested in what we were doing.
Now, listen, your memoir closes with this sentence. Then in 2010, Pat told me she had retired and closed the business down. Meanwhile, I'd got involved in a new publishing venture, Press On. We now have the memoir. Now, you've touched on this, but I'll ask it formally. What do you see as the legacy of Pat Woolley saying to you in 1973, when she didn't know your name, I want to start a publishing company one day called Wild and Woolley?
Well, at one point the partnership turned a bit sour, and there was a little bit of litigation between us. And I said to the solicitor, I said, "Oh, well, that's it. That's cured me of publishing." He said, "No, it hasn't." And so in 1990, Philip Edmonds was in touch with me. He got a book which he's finding trouble getting published. I said, "Look, nobody's going to publish this. This is literary, it's political. Nobody's going to touch it unless you find a small press where somebody wants to publish because they're not trying to make money. They just want to publish quality fiction." He said, "Let's do it." So I said, "Oh, I've got no reason not to." So we set up Press On. We didn't incorporate. We had no money. It was never a legal entity.
Do you have a rubber stamp?
No, we got a website, though.
Okay.
The next best thing. And then that, you know, we got subscriptions. We got the first book out, Peter Corris. We had a book of mine, a book of Philip's waiting. And then, out of the blue, Nick Walker, who runs Australian Scholarly Publishing, which is has been going for 20 years doing academic scholarly books, said, "Would I like to come in and help him on his fiction list?" I said, "Sure." I said, "But I just started a small press. Shall I bring that in?" He said, "Sure." So I phoned up Philip, thinking he might be, you know, giving his baby away. I said, "We had this offer." He said, "Thank heavens." So now, just this month, we've got 7 new titles out. We've got 12 titles altogether, another 4 coming. And the crisis in publishing at the moment is such that the big corporations, which are heavily indebted, you know, and now every book has to make money. You can't say, "I made money on a cookery book, so we'll subsidise fiction." And to make money, for corporations that size with their overheads, you've really got to do a print run of 6,000. Now, a new challenging work of fiction, is, you know, non-genre, is you're going to be pushing it to sell more than 1,000 first off. It's always been the same. It'll take on, it'll get reprinted, it'll be a sleeper, hopefully, you know, it'll happen. But the first print run, you're not, a large company, they can't afford to do it. So this means that now, you set up a company now, as we did, suddenly you've got really top writers who've got manuscripts. We've got Peter Corris, we've got Gary Disher, we've got Maurice Lurie, we've got Ross Fitzgerald, we've got Ian Callanan, we've got James Murray, we've got Victoria Thompson, we've got Inez Barinet. They've all got commercial track records. They're all recognised, established writers. This is amazing to start a new company and get writers of that quality. Because of the global crisis, and particularly the crisis in Australia, the Australian end of the global publishing. So, yeah, in one way things are bad with the global financial crisis, and the other way this creates amazing new opportunities. And with the, you know, the fact that you can do small print runs. And I've had a number of publishing operations, you know, and I've never actually lost money. I never made any money. If you want to make money, you've got to take huge risks. You've got to do large print runs.
But you take small risks all the time.
Small risks. But you cost it. You think, well, I'm not going to lose too much on that.
Yes.
You know, so it always pays its weight. It doesn't make a profit, but that, you know, I had a day job.
Michael Wilding, you may not appreciate this observation, but Schumpeter talked about creative destruction, which happens in capitalist societies, and from what you've been describing, the big boys fall apart and the micro publishers just pick up all the quality and the game goes on.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
Michael Wilding is the author of Wild and Woolly, a publishing memoir available locally from Giramondo Publishing Company and distributed by New South Books.